Statutory construction. In the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act of 1998, or SLUSA, Congress precluded state law class actions that allege misconduct in connection with, and I put those words in quote, the purchase or sale of securities. All agree, Your Honors, that the in connection with requirement of SLUSA was incorporated from the similar, substantively identical provision of Section 10B of the Exchange Act. And all agree that when Congress adopts terms of art in this fashion, it is presumed to have incorporated judicial constructions of those terms. The dispute in this case, the principal dispute, is which construction Congress has adopted. Our position is straightforward. The in connection with requirement of SLUSA is as expansive as the parallel provision of Section 10B, as construed in cases...
Does the answer to this question matter in this case? I mean, I ask for two reasons. One, it looks like the class has in it, the multiple classes have in it, people who bought or sold during the class period. And second, it looks like everybody in the class, if one of the allegations of the class is that the funds didn't follow through on statements in their prospectus, it looks like all of them may have bought in connection with the statements in the prospectus. So I wonder whether this case presents the interesting legal question both sides would like us to tackle.
It does, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, as the court noted, we have certainly argued our fallback position is that even if the blue chip stamps limitation applies to SLUSA, these complaints meet it. The question presented, however, that the question I started with is presented for two reasons, I said. First, if the court doesn't decide that question, then the plaintiffs in this and many other cases have a roadmap for evasion of SLUSA.
Wait a minute, though. I mean, obviously SLUSA covers some things and it doesn't cover other things. I had very much the same question Judge Easterbrook did because I was looking at the class definition and the complaints that are furnished. The one I happen to be looking at is on Appendix 153A, but I think they're all roughly the same. And it doesn't seem to limit the class to people who have, from the beginning of time, had shares in these funds. It just says all persons in the United States who held shares during this rather long period of time, especially when you figure that it's only a two-week period that you have to hold them.
Correct, Your Honor.
So it seems to me this class inevitably has people, even apart from the fact that the prospectus point is there, it must have people who purchase mutual fund shares. Now, your argument, I think, is that we have to go all the way out to the market timers' shares, but I don't see why that comes up.
Your Honor, as I said, in six of the seven complaints, you're absolutely correct. The class definition is all persons who held for 2 weeks within a five-year period, which necessarily includes purchasers or sellers. The class definition does not exclude purchasers or sellers, and we think that comes within SLUSA under any definition. The Spurgeon complaint, the seventh of these cases, and this is in the appendix, Your Honors, at page 309A, does contain an allegation that it's paragraph 40. Excluded from the complaint are any claims based upon conduct in connection with plaintiffs or any class members' purchase or sale of the annuities at issue, which are the securities in the Spurgeon case. So one of the seven cases does, in fact, contain an allegation or an attempt to exclude purchasers and sellers from the class. This provision that was the last filed complaint, I think it's not a coincidence that provision was put in after we started to file our papers in the earlier cases making this argument. If that is allowed to succeed...
Well, of course, that's only half of where I began, which is that if the claim of fraud, and I'll pursue later whether there is a real claim of fraud here, but if the claim of fraud is that these plaintiffs were deceived by the prospectuses into thinking that these funds were arbitrage-proof, then necessarily all the plaintiffs, unless they inherited the shares from their great-grandmother, made purchases in connection with that incorrect statement in the prospectus.
That's correct, Your Honor. It stated that way, the case is indistinguishable from Dudek, for example, where the underlying allegation is simply a misrepresentation as to the appropriateness of an investment. Here, the misrepresentation alleged is the appropriateness of the pricing of this investment. If essentially, they say that either they paid too much or somebody else paid too little, which amounts to the same thing in a mutual fund, since they all the investors own undivided shares of the trust.
Okay. Well, I think I understand your position on this. So let me ask you one other question that you may view as a distraction, which is why these complaints come within SLUSA in the first place. I mean, SLUSA is limited to complaints charging fraud or manipulation. But why aren't these complaints best understood as substantive dilution complaints, which under Santa Fe Industries against Green are not claims of fraud at all?
Your Honor, the two answers to that as well. First is plaintiffs have never challenged the fraudulent or misconduct aspect of...
I noticed that their brief doesn't invoke Santa Fe.
Well, and nowhere in any of the
why
papers...
Why shouldn't their brief invoke Santa Fe? Okay. Why isn't this a Santa Fe case?
Because, Your Honor, their claim really is at bottom... that the prospectuses failed to disclose the opportunities for market timing, and therefore their purchases were their subsequent holdings after the purchases were diluted because of that transaction that was not disclosed, or those transactions, the possibility of which was not disclosed.
But that's the very kind of thing Santa Fe rejected. One might as well have said in Santa Fe that Santa Fe didn't disclose that the managers might merge the firm out at too low a price, and therefore all substantive pricing errors are violations of the securities law. And that was rejected as clearly as one could imagine. And the Supreme Court said that's a state law theory. Now, my question is, why isn't this just a state law theory in state court?
Your Honor, let me if I can break that into two parts. Whether they have stated a viable cause of action under federal law, I will certainly agree with a premise of the court's question, which is I don't think they have. But that isn't the touchstone for the SLUSA question. SLUSA says, does not say, as the plaintiffs would have.
I understand. It depends on what they allege. But the question I'm asking is it sound to conclude that these complaints allege fraud, correctly or incorrectly?
Your Honor, I think the better characterization is that these complaints allege a material omission. Whether or not that omission is material, we could debate in the appropriate forum. In the prospectus, as to the possibility of the arbitrage that is... the arbitrage that is made possible by the ICA pricing scheme.
Well, there it depends. I mean, the material omission you're now arguing has to do with prospectus, and much of your brief is devoted to the theory that, in a sense, it's a method of doing business, a manipulative or deceptive device that the funds are alleged to have engaged in, namely by using these so-called stale, several-hour-old time periods for evaluating the foreign securities. But that doesn't get to, in other words, you have got to correlate what the alleged wrongdoing is with what the theory is, which sale you're talking about. And if it's the prospectus and the dilution of the value in the mutual funds, maybe it is a state law issue.
Well, Your Honor, there are two theories, and the complaints are not entirely clear. One is the omission from the prospectus that this was possible. The other was what they characterize as the choice to employ market prices rather than fair valuation.
Right, which is kind of an ongoing business practice.
Well, it happens every day, Your Honor.
Right.
The fund NAV is set every single day.
Sure.
Their allegation is that every single day,
in fact, yeah,
the defendant makes a decision to use market prices rather than...
complaining about the fund's business decisions, and that's the kind of thing that Santa Fe said is a state law claim properly in state court. And, it used to be that the defense bar would stand up on Santa Fe and say, look, this is not a federal securities claim, and now we seem to be in the opposite world where the defense bar wants to minimize what happened in Santa Fe and kind of sweep these into federal law so they get killed.
But let me be clear, Your Honor, I'm in no way arguing that these claims, as cast, could be recharacterized as any viable federal claim. I do not believe they can be. My point is that SLUSA does not require a viable federal claim for preemption.
No, I understand it doesn't require it to be viable, but it requires it to be, as you say, they've used the magic language of 10B. Right, and 10B talks not only about purchase or sale, it talks about untrue statement or omission of a material fact. And one has to come within both parts of the magic language of 10B. And Santa Fe has told us what untrue statement or omission of a material fact is in connection with claims of corporate mismanagement. And this does seem to me most sensibly understood as a claim of corporate mismanagement.
And Your Honor, we may well make that argument. There's a parallel MDL proceeding in which all these same issues are being litigated under the federal securities laws. That the time for motions to dismiss has not yet arisen, it is quite likely we will make that argument. But that argument has never been made by these plaintiffs in this case. They have only challenged the in connection with requirement, and you know, we take this case as it was brought to
so
us
perhaps,
and to this
so
court.
Perhaps will we, but and I'll stop harassing you now so you can get on with the argument.
Your Honor, I understand the point.
We need to understand whether this was really properly here.
Your Honor, it is... there's a footnote in one of the cases that points out this inconsistency or perceived inconsistency of the defense bar arguing one thing or the other. The way I like to, or the one way that I can cut through that issue, two ways I can cut through that issue. One is to consider the commission's enforcement authority, whether the commission could bring an action on these facts against one of the mutual fund's defendants. I think there would be problems even in that action on the first aspect, the misconduct aspect. There would be no problem on the in connection with aspect. And O'Hagan makes very clear that the breach of duty...
If the commission brought this suit, you'd be saying the commission is alleging corporate mismanagement, not fraud or an omission.
But we would not be challenging the in connection with requirement, Your Honor. And O'Hagan makes clear that they have to be... that the duty aspect and the in connection with aspect are two separate inquiries.
I understand, but that's my question. Haven't you been all arguing in the district court in your briefs the wrong part of SLUSA?
Well... we removed under SLUSA. The plaintiffs challenged only the in connection with requirement. We pointed out that they were wrong on that. If the court would like to send it back for other proceedings, we don't think you should do that. They made their litigation decisions, and the only question before the court is in connection with. O'Hagan, as I said, makes very clear that that question is separate and distinct and separable from the misconduct question. In fact, Zandford took the misconduct question as decided from the Fourth Circuit and decided only the in connection with requirement. So this court certainly would be on firm footing to take it exactly that way, the way the plaintiffs chose to litigate this case. So I appreciate the court's concern, but that's the way it comes here.
Yep.
I see I am rapidly running out of time. I really am here to answer questions rather
than
give a speech.
Having distracted you, I will give both sides an extra 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. As we've said, the in connection with requirement, which we think is the only question before the court, the plaintiffs present a false choice, the blue chip stamps limitation, when really the question is O'Hagan.
Both O'Hagan and Zandford involve purchases and sales in a way that I think is closer than you are portraying it in your briefs. And blue chip, in contrast, actually identifies a class where they think the Birnbaum rule, which they're talking about there, wouldn't apply, of people who are suffering loss in the value of their investment due to corporate or insider activities. So I don't know. I mean, I think you're drawing a very sharp dichotomy between the blue chip rule and the Zandford and O'Hagan rule.
Well, let me make 2 points in response to that, Your Honor. First is they have never disputed that we would win under the O'Hagan rule. They need to go to blue chip stamps in order to maintain their position. Second, they and the district court ignore the part of blue chip stamps. It's on page 738 of the court's opinion. They like to focus on footnote 9, which says that the Birnbaum rule is ameliorated to the extent that state law remedies are available. Of course, they put in ellipses where the court says to the extent that, because in SLUSA, Congress limited.
While we're talking about ellipses, in your brief, you portray blue chip as a purely policy-based decision, whereas the ordinary reader of blue chip wades through about 6 or 7 pages of Justice Rehnquist's discussion of 10b. So I find it hard to see this as just the court saying, well, now we're going to make up a bunch of federal common law about this. They're construing the statute.
Your Honor, I disagree with you. I think subsequent
you're kidding.
Respectfully,
I will rest with
Justice Scalia on this question, Your Honor, who said the limitation we approved.
He wasn't on the court at the time Justice Rehnquist wrote this opinion.
The limitation we approved in blue chip stamps was essentially a legislative judgment rather than an interpretive one.
Oh.
I believe that to be true, and I believe that subsequent cases bear that out. My point, though, about page 738 is that the court, when it talks about the cases that are excluded by the Birnbaum rule, specifically the Holder cases, went out of its way to say those cases often can be brought in state court as derivative actions. SLUSA expressly exempts derivative actions from its preclusive reach.
Right.
If they could meet the requirements of a derivative case, which they can't, then they could take advantage of that language in blue chip stamps. But this action, we submit, is well within the plain language of SLUSA. It's what Congress intended to preempt, did preempt, and that none of the arguments offered by the district court about the cognizability of a parallel federal action really have any bearing on that question. The court has no further questions.
Oh, I do have one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I take it nothing has happened yet in the Second Circuit. I looked at their docket recently in the Second Circuit case is under advisement now, 9 months after argument.
There are two Second Circuit cases. One is the Davitt case that we submitted the brief in, the other one called IJG, which is referenced in a footnote. Mm-hmm. I checked on Wednesday, and neither one of those have been decided yet.
I trust that one or the other of you will notify us as soon as the Second Circuit does something in Davitt.
We will certainly endeavor to do so, and I suspect one of the lawyers in this room will get an inkling of it.
Thank you, Mr. Perry.
Thank you.
Mr. Svetkov.
May it please the court, my name is Sandy Svetkov from San Francisco. With me at council table is Robert King, who wrote the brief in this case, which I kibitzed on, so I take full responsibility for its content. First of all, Judge Easterbrook, I disagree that the in connection with requirement is not at stake here. It is. The substantive dilution claim that we bring did not occur in connection with the purchase or sale. It happens afterward. It happens after the plaintiffs bought their stock and before they sell the stock. Every member of the class buys and sells at some point. That's not the question. Under blue chip, the test is:
What do you view as the violation here?
The substantive dilution of the plaintiff class's shares.
But let me ask you a hypothetical about that. Suppose the prospectus for these funds laid out in excruciating detail the way that the value was going to be calculated, the net asset value was going to be calculated, and said, we're going to take the closing price on all these various exchanges, and it's going to be 17 hours old in some instances, and it's going to be 15 minutes old in others, et cetera, et cetera. And so everybody who bought a share knew that there was going to be embedded in this system an opportunity for arbitrage, and they go ahead and buy the shares. They figure, well, it's a well-managed company. It's not going to hurt me that much, or whatever they think. They just buy the shares. There was nothing illegal, as I understand it anyway, about valuing the shares that way per se. There was no SEC rule that said you can't do it that way. So why doesn't that suggest that in fact this really is all about whether they understood what they were buying or not at the time?
Because they're not bringing a claim that they were misled in any way to buy the stock.
But if they weren't misled, what was the problem?
Your Honor, it's a good investment. It should be a better investment because
that would be to say you could file the investors of General Motors could file a lawsuit against General Motors saying they didn't design the drivetrain on the latest Impala correctly, and as a result of that, we lost as investors because they lost profits, and we're entitled to recover. And that wouldn't be a good legal claim of any kind.
But that, I don't know if that is or is not.
Why is this any different? The managers of the fund have adopted a business practice which somewhat reduces the returns of the fund, as in my example GM did. Seems to me it gets to be a problem only if there's some divergence between what they did and what they told you.
No.
What they told your clients.
Assuming they told us nothing. They told us they were good managers, that you're going to get diversified shares and invest in us. And we
do. But
that's a derivative claim which you have to file under state law in the corporate headquarters after making demand on the board. You're not making a derivative claim.
No, we're not bringing any claim that deals with the purchase or sale of the stock. That's the point. This is afterward.
Mr. Svetkov, the reason I ask this is because your way of trying to formulate what was wrong as being unrelated to the stock makes it a derivative attack on the adequacy of corporate management, and you have not filed this as a derivative suit.
No, no. You see, you said not related to the stock. I didn't say that. I said not related to the purchase or sale thereof. That's different.
Mr. Fetkoff, you're trying to make this into a federal claim, and I'm trying to tell you it's a state claim for negligence.
I'm sorry, Judge Easterbrook.
Trying to shout down a question from the court is not a useful argument strategy.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Let me come back to my question. Could you restate your theory of wrongdoing in such a way that it is not a derivative suit?
The allegation is negligent valuation of the shares under
state law.
That's
a claim that the managers have behaved negligently in management of the firm, and it has to be brought as a derivative suit. That's why I'm puzzled. I'm trying to figure out how you get any claim that is neither a derivative suit nor somehow involves the federal securities law disclosures.
Well, I guess my first problem is the validity of the state claim is not the question before this court. What is before this court is whether or not this state claim is a federal claim in disguise. And our submission is it is not. Whether or not it is a valid claim of negligence under state law is for a state court to determine, not for this court to determine. And I don't know how to dress it up any differently. The dilution claim alleges negligence under state law. If it doesn't state a claim under state law, the defendants will move before a state court judge and say we don't state a claim under state law. And that's what they should do. That's not before us today, Judge Easterbrook. What's before us today is whether that state negligence claim is a securities claim in disguise. And it cannot be a securities claim in disguise for at least the reason that the act of negligence and the injury derived from the negligence does not occur at the point of purchase or sale of the stock by the plaintiffs. And therefore, under Blue Chip, this is not within the scope of either 10B or SLUSA. It really is a straightforward and simple proposition. Whether we have a valid negligence claim against the management is simply not at stake at this point. Now, I have to say that we've raised a second point in our briefs, and it's directly related to the first. Not only is there no preemption here, but the absence of preemption at the start of this case meant that there was not a proper removal. And no district judge in any of these cases ever held that the removal was proper. That I looked at the docket in every case. There is no such holding. Now, there is a procedure in 1446C in criminal cases for an immediate determination of whether the removal is proper or not. But this is not a criminal case. So there was no determination of jurisdiction at the point that the case was removed. That was a unilateral decision by the defense. Then what happened was a motion for remand. And every district court judge said, the jurisdictional question before us is this. Was this case properly removed in the first instance? This is not an Amoco case where something happened later. And even in Atkins, which I know both Judge Wood and Judge Ripple were on opposite
all know
sides.
These cases, but Mr. Spedio, let me just kind of cut you off. I mean, as you know, this court, the entire court, because of a 40E circulation, considered the earlier decision. You are certainly entitled to ask us to reconsider it, but you've briefed it, and I don't know that there's a lot that you're mentioning that we weren't aware of and that was not addressed in the opinion.
The point that I make is this is a jurisdictional question. It's never waived. It's never off the table.
I'm not saying it's waived. I'm just saying in terms of allocation of your argument time, I mean, I assure you every member of the court thought about it in voting on the Rule 40E, and if you want us to think about it some more, we'll think about it some more.
I don't see that you can divorce the jurisdictional point from the preemption point. The substantive point drives the removal point and vice versa. And what my submission to you is I don't even think you can reach the preemption point. In other words, I think you have to say, I don't have jurisdiction to decide this. But if you do say you have jurisdiction, which I can't see you consistently doing, and also fight for us on the merits. If we're right on the merits on the preemption question.
I mean, there are opportunities for interlocutory appeal in certain areas, and the Supreme Court has gone a long way down the post-Thermtron path. Maybe they shouldn't have even started that process, but they did, and we have followed their many, many exceptions to, if I can call them that, to 1447D. Anyway, I think you should come back to the core of your case, you know, the SLUSA preemption, because what we have here are some kind of two different candidates for the sales we ought to think about in connection with either the original purchases of the mutual fund shares or sales of them, and then these other purchases and sales of the arbitrageurs off there, you know, taking advantage of this. And on the first of those, I think your opponent's backup argument, if you will, we win even if it's blue chip, is one you might want to spend a few minutes on.
But I don't see how they can win if it's blue chip. If it's blue chip, then the substantive violation has to connect with the plaintiff's purchase or sale, and that's not our claim.
Well,
we win under blue chip because the wording of blue chip and the holding of blue chip is that in a private securities action, which is what SLUSA addresses, the purchase or sale must be the plaintiff's purchase or sale, and that's not our claim. Our claim is outside of 10B, and therefore outside of SLUSA, Judge Wood. Now,
in your class definition, too, doesn't exclude people who purchased or sold. You're saying that the reason your shares would never have been diluted if they weren't your shares. Maybe I can put it that way. I realize that the active mechanism for diluting them was what somebody else did, and maybe that's important. But
no, it's not only that someone else did it. And I, let's be clear. Under O'Hagan and under Zandford, when the government brings a suit, civilly or criminally, the linkage is between the fraudulent substantive conduct and any purchase or sale. I grant you that. I'm not quarreling with that. But when a private party brings a private suit under 10B and right, as defined in SLUSA, there is an additional requirement. The word plaintiff is inserted in the wording of the in connection with purchase or sale. It's in connection with the plaintiff's purchase or sale. And I find that in the wording by looking to Justice Rehnquist's description, not in footnote 9, but in footnote 5 of Blue Chip. Beyond this, the wording of Section 10B, making fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of security a violation of the Act, is surely badly strained when construed to provide a cause of action, not to purchasers and sellers of securities, but to the world at large. That's the principal part of Blue Chip that controls here. That's the part that informs this decision. That's the part that adopts the Birnbaum rule on the language of the statute. And that's the language that applies in SLUSA, because SLUSA is only about private securities cases. Only about. And so that must be what controls SLUSA. Not Zandford, not O'Hagan, not what the SEC can do, not what the U.S. attorney can do, but what private parties can do. And we read that very carefully. And we did not plead any kind of substantive claim in connection with our purchase or our sale. We pled a substantive claim about what happened as we held the stock. And we allege that every day that we held the stock, the stale valuation exposed us to market timing traders whose trades diluted the value of our stock. It's one thing to say, look, they misled us into buying this and I paid too much money for it. That's fraud. That's preempted. I wouldn't be here. That's not this case. And they cannot make out of the descriptive language in the paragraph 38 of one of these complaints that says something about the market timers those who bought and held the stock had their money transferred to market timers. That's a descriptive paragraph. It's not a charging paragraph. It's not a class definition. The class definitions in all but one of these complaints is specific. It says holders. In one of these complaints, the smart one that Mr. King and my partner drafted at the very end to avoid the claim that Mr. Perry was making that you never excluded purchasers and sellers, we added that in I think it's Appendix 203 to the Pacific Life complaint. But that's like putting a belt on with suspenders. You don't need to hold the pants up with both. And the point is, most of these complaints stand because by saying the class are strictly holders, we do effectively exclude purchasers and sellers. More than that, we describe the conduct as having occurred not at the time of purchase or sale. Therefore, the in connection with requirement is not met. Not at the time of the plaintiff's purchase or sale. Pardon me. Yes, it might have been at the time of the market timer's purchase or sale, but that only gives the SEC and the United States Attorney a claim. It doesn't give a private party a claim. And that's the difference between 10B and SLUSA for private parties.
Mr.
I'm sorry,
Svetkov,
Judge. Yes.
What weight you think we should give to the SEC's view in the Davitt amicus brief?
It's not Chevron deference, Your Honor.
Well, that's obvious.
Right.
So this is Skidmore or nothing. So I'm really asking a question about how that works under Skidmore.
My take on it is that the SEC position is incorrect. And it's
that's a different question.
Yes, and I don't think you have to give that any deference because you're construing a statute, and the court is in just as good a position as the SEC to figure it out, not better.
Maybe I should ask the question in a different way. What weight has the Supreme Court said that SEC understandings of these things have when the time comes for private actions? Now, I'm acutely aware, for example, that the SEC's view was rejected in blue chip stamps. I wrote the SEC's brief in blue chip stamps. They rejected that. But what weight do you think they get? The Supreme Court said the SEC's brief in that case was poorly reasoned, so.
I think that it's entitled to consideration, but it's not certainly not deferential or dispositive, and I think that in my own view of it is that it will throw a bone to the SEC when it wants to go that direction, and it will say, as in blue chip, it not persuasive if they don't want to go that way. Unless the court has any questions, I am prepared to submit.
I only had one last question, which, since you're emphatically, according to you, not bringing a derivative action claiming mismanagement of the funds by the people in charge of them, what is actually your state law theory? You're talking about breaches of duty of care, but from where does this duty of care stem?
Well, they're common law claims.
I know, but part of the common law? There's a lot of common law.
Yeah. Well, the count one is a negligence claim as to, and count two is a willful or reckless breach of fiduciary duty.
All right, so you're claiming that the managers had a fiduciary duty. Okay.
My problem with going beyond what that claim is to say, I'm happy to talk about that in state court,
you think you're going to do if you're not under anything that's sort of a copy of the securities laws and thus under SLUSA problems, or if you're not over in derivative land,
Let's posit that I'm in derivative land.
Yeah, but it's not filed as a derivative complaint. It doesn't have the right defendants. You didn't use the right procedures. Right? My problem, we have to characterize what the state law complaint is about. It's not a derivative complaint. The question is, can we think of a good characterization of a non-derivative complaint that is also a non-10B complaint? That's the problem. Is there some concrete Illinois law that you're relying on, some concrete Illinois law or decision that you're relying on for the proposition that you've got a state law theory which is neither a derivative theory nor a securities law theory?
Well, and for example, in the Eighth Circuit case, it was a breach of contract. Everybody understands breaches of contract. Yeah. The guy was paying $20 a month, you know, getting his information, and they weren't giving him what he bargained for.
I have to say I'm flabbergasted. Since when has this common law disappeared? The common law recognizes claims of negligence in every state in the union, either by common law or codification of criminal law. Common law.
My understanding is that all states require complaints about managers' negligent behavior to be brought as derivative rather than direct suits, unless the person bringing the suit suffers a unique injury not suffered by other investors. That's not the nature of your claim. Now, it may be that I misunderstand the distinction between direct and derivative suits. That's one reason why I was asking you for what you were relying on as the state authority. So I can see how you fit this in.
I appreciate what you're saying, but we're limited to the record. The record has a complaint. The complaint has a negligence claim. I can't manufacture an explanation beyond that which the record presents, nor which our opponents have not suggested is not a negligence claim under state law. I don't know how to fix
okay.
that.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spetkoff. Anything further, Mr. Perry?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
When Congress enacted SLUSA, it explained that it was enacting national standards for class action lawsuits involving nationally traded securities. That's a quote from the Balin case, quoting the legislative history. This is a class action lawsuit involving nationally traded securities.
But, of course, Congress also carved out. It wasn't saying it was occupying the field. It has lots of exceptions, such as the derivative actions that we're talking about. And it also used the 10B language. So there's an awful lot of securities law out there that it wasn't bringing in, too.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the Congress made that balance between the state and federal courts. It carved out exceptions that do not include this case. You heard Mr. Svetkoff concede that if O'Hagan controls, he loses. And we submit that it does. The claim...
But your argument is that it's impossible to have a separate regime, if you will, for private actions and for government actions, and that's just patently not true. I can think of dozens of antitrust examples where, say, United States against United States gypsum, where the government has to have very, you know, a high standard of scienter in its criminal prosecutions for all sorts of good reasons, and that doesn't apply to private cases. The court just decided Empagran. It would not be an unusual thing to worry specifically about private actions.
It's a good point, Your Honor, but the situation here is different. And let me offer RICO as an example. A RICO plaintiff claiming 10B violations as the two predicate acts need not be a purchaser or seller of the securities, according to the majority rule in the circuits and four justices of the sitting Supreme Court. That's Holmes versus Sipic. These distinctions sometimes are drawn and sometimes aren't drawn. In that context...
Your argument was that it was preposterous to think that there could be a difference.
I hope I didn't use the word preposterous. Let me try to draw this, drive this home a little bit.
It's certainly not preposterous. It is the law in 2.5 circuits.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Certainly the 8th, certainly the 11th, and the 9th Circuit firmly straddles both sides of the fence.
It is certainly dictum in 2.5 circuits, Your Honor. It's never actually been presented. Blue Chip Stamps itself, and let me turn to page 743 of that decision. The court said that the Birnbaum rule will prevent some private plaintiffs who have been damaged by violations of 10B from bringing suit. There can only be a violation of 10B if the in connection with requirement is met. So the Supreme Court itself acknowledged that there will be cases where the in connection with requirement is met, the private plaintiff can't bring a cause of action. Congress did not insert that word plaintiffs in the statute. It just put the in connection with requirement in. We submit that that's enough under SLUSA if they can't fit with one of the exceptions. On this derivative case point, we argued in the court below that this case should be brought as a derivative case. They disagreed. They refused to bring it as a derivative case. So to the extent there's any question of remand for that purpose, there's no reason to because they've already disavowed it.
Of course, if they did bring it as a derivative case, SLUSA just vanishes instantly, right?
Well, the derivative case, if it's a proper derivative case, is not covered by SLUSA. There are a bunch of other problems they'd have with their derivative case.
But you would be in state court in the world of state law.
Well, we might be in federal court because we probably have diversity jurisdiction, Your Honor. If they brought it in Illinois. Well,
one would hope same
we'll
thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until next week.